What is up, everybody? On behalf of everyone here at Digital 410 Media, I just want to say happy Thanksgiving. And we're doing it again. We're doing a back-to-back Patreon giveaway. So if you have yet to decide to sign up for Patreon, please head over to patreon.com/D410. Sign up for the December member prize giveaway. This month, we are thrilled to feature the beautiful exclusive print from Military Aerospace Art, showcasing the incredible bravery of First Lieutenant Huey Lamb Jr. The stunning piece captures a historic mission on March 19th, 1945, with Lieutenant Lamb piloting his P-51 Mustang, the Etta Jean II. Intercepting and destroying a low-flying Ardo 234 jet. Don't miss your chance to own the slice of World War II aviation history that is autographed by Huey Lamb Jr. Thank you guys so much for your continued support through 2024. We're looking forward to 2025. Happy Thanksgiving, and we love you all.
Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts Don Abernathy and Jeff Kopsa.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. As always, we are filming. I wish we were filming. We are recording live. I haven't even started drinking my bourbon yet. We're recording or digitized live here in the At Computer Studio in Cape Coral, Florida. But as always, joining us from Texas, our friend Jeff Kopsetta. Jeff, how are you, sir?
Good, sir. How are you?
You know, at some point, I need to write down the name of the town. That way, I can say, joining us from Texas is our friend Jeff Kopsetta. But, you know, it's just things are just so darn crazy. But how is your Thanksgiving going this year, sir?
You know, I mean, every year for me is it's the best year. So it was the best Thanksgiving. I mean, it was small, but it was personal and it was good, man. I mean, you know, it's you don't take anything for granted anymore.
Isn't that the truth? That's kind of the one. If there's a silver lining or a good thing, quote unquote, to come from COVID, at least early on, I don't know, maybe now we're all jaded again, but at least early on, we all kind of sat back when we didn't know exactly where this pandemic was going to take us, how severe it was, if we were going to see the casualty numbers that they originally predicted. And we all kind of paused our lives and looked around and said, holy crap. And I think a lot of us, at least for a period of time, were a little more grateful for every day we had in our family and the opportunities we have. But kind of like with anything else, as time goes by, we start to fall back in our old ruts and our old system again. And I think a lot of those thankfulness may have fallen to the wayside.
Yeah, maybe so, but we'll enjoy it while it lasts.
Let me ask you a question. I usually drink a beer during these things, but I'm kind of trying to watch my empty calories. And so I switched over to bourbon. And I know that you enjoy a cigar and a drink from time to time. What is your liqueur of choice?
Actually, I'm a wine guy. I got a glass right now. I mean, I'll have a good glass of bourbon every now and then. You know, there's a distillery right down the road here that's it was actually the first distillery in Texas, and it's just really grown in proportion. And of course, we're right in the heart of wine country. You know, we've talked about that before, but Garrison Brothers is a local distillery here, and they do very well. They make excellent bourbon. But no, I'm typically a wine guy, man. I'm mostly Portuguese, so that's in my blood, I guess.
You know, I've been drinking the Maker's Mark for years now. Not that I'm a bourbon connoisseur. I did discover that a Jim Beam is more of a mixing bourbon, not so much of a sipping bourbon, if you know what I mean. It just kind of...
Right.
It doesn't have that taste to it. It's just not a good straight bourbon. No hacks towards you Jim Beam fans. But I recently discovered this stuff called Larceny.
Huh.
It's a small batch 92 proof weeded bourbon, which, yes, I know it sounds redundant, but that's actually what they call it. It's a weeded bourbon. And I've been enjoying it. It's pretty darn good. And my dad brought over some Crown Royal yesterday, but it's like, well, what's the point? I got this going on. So it's Thanksgiving time, and we had a small little get-together here yesterday. We had about 8 people, maybe 7. But I was, you know, we've all seen, being World War II aficionados, we've all seen the World War II photos of the guys in the front lines and the foxholes, you know, eating a turkey leg and having their mess kits out with the... all the accoutrements. But I got to looking around today. I'm almost like, what do we not know about Thanksgiving and World War II? Did you know that prior to us getting involved in the war, right on the heels of the Great Depression, Roosevelt toyed around and actually changed the date of Thanksgiving for 3 years.
Really?
Yes. In the summer of 1939, concerned retailers approached President Franklin Roosevelt. This is poorly written, so I'm just reading verbatim. Approached President Franklin Roosevelt, period. The Christmas shopping season had never started before Thanksgiving. But in 1939, Thanksgiving, which had been celebrated on the last Thursday of November since 1863, would land on November 30th, which would curtail revenue. In August of 1939, Roosevelt issued a presidential proclamation changing Thanksgiving to the third Thursday of November. It was a hugely unpopular decision. While 32 states adopted the earlier date, 16 refused. In 1939, 40, and 41, two dates were celebrated, depending on the state. The later original date was sometimes nicknamed the Republican Thanksgiving, and the new early date, the Democrat Thanksgiving, or the Franksgiving, I guess because of Franklin. By 1941, Roosevelt admitted the earlier date had absolutely no effect on retail sales figures, and so on October 6, 1941, the House of Representatives voted to move Thanksgiving back to the last Thursday of November. The Senate amended the bill on December 9, 1941, despite the previous day's declaration of war on Japan. Now imagine that, if you will. It's December 9, 1941. Yesterday, he just gave the speech about, you know, being attacked, the day that would go down in infamy, and we just, you know, declared war on Japan. But it's the very next day. Let's get back to the serious task that we've all been waiting for on bated breath, and that is, what day will we celebrate Thanksgiving on? So despite that the previous day they declared war in Japan, they make the holiday fall on the fourth Thursday to accommodate the date. The president signed the legislation on December 26, 1941. Now, here's an interesting thing. I'm not going to read all this verbatim, but I found an interesting chart on here, and it's talking about Macy's Day Parade. Rubber was one of the most critical wartime shortages, since 92% of American supply came from Japanese occupied land, which I never knew that before. I didn't know that at the time Japan held 92% of the properties that grew rubber trees. Were you aware of that?
It's essentially the French Indochina Peninsula. Or what became Vietnam and the Philippines. I think that's where most of the rubber for the world comes from, is those two locations.
And so on November 13th, 1942, Macy's department store ceremoniously handed over their famous giant rubber balloons used in the annual parades, including Superman, who had only made his debut in 1939. The balloons were shredded for scrap rubber. But here's the interesting thing. They have a little cute little chart here. A gas mask required 1.1 pounds of rubber. Not too bad, because most of that's a canister. A life raft required 17 to 100 pounds of rubber. I guess it depends on the type of rubber and the thickness. The scout car required, I guess, for tires and, maybe hoses and things like that. 306 pounds of rubber, and a heavy bomber required 1,825 pounds of rubber. And so, jeez. I mean, it just goes to show you, we are all kind of complaining about now, about some certain states can only have, you know, so many people over. But, you know, looking over to my left here in my cabinet, I still have, which I'm super proud of, I have the remnants of a wartime ration stamp book. Mm. And all these Thanksgiving, all of the Thanksgiving Day ingredients were being rationed. And so a lot of the housewives, having foresight, they would start a few months out to ration their rations so that they would have extra ration stamps available to them so that they can go out and get the things they needed in order to procure their Thanksgiving dinner. And so imagine trying to put together Thanksgiving dinner on for ration stamps.
Gosh, I know. Just a different time, man. You got me hung up when, I mean, I couldn't even imagine if this was today.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine the press conference in December, you know, after the attack on Pearl, and we know we're at war in Germany and Italy declare war on us 2 days later, you know, there'd be somebody in that room. So, Office President, now, what about the Thanksgiving thing again? Because you still haven't let us know. That would be today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're at war, right? Yeah, we get we're at war, but we need to finalize this Thanksgiving.
Yeah, because, you know, there'd be these editorialize things on Twitter, and there'd be these YouTube videos from Walmart and all them. We don't know which day, if we don't know when to celebrate Thanksgiving, how could we possibly know when to have Black Friday? We can't have two Black Fridays.
On strike. I didn't know, honestly, I did not know Thanksgiving dated back that far, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I was trying to find more information on this, and what I discovered was that basically two different websites utilized a lot of the same material. And I found, changes, ration shortages. I actually found one article that explained all the different dates, how it actually started. Because even back, Lincoln had it on a completely different day. So, I mean, it went way back.
Huh.
I don't think I saved that page. I'd have to, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy. Thanksgiving during World War II. Oh, imagine. I love how my phone search is synchronized with my computer searches. No, it's the same page. But yeah, basically, the date had been changed, like, I think, throughout history, like, 3 to 4 different times. Because I know Lincoln had it on a certain date, and then it was moved. And then it was moved again. I want to say maybe... Abraham Lincoln was not the first president to urge the Americans to celebrate Thanksgiving. Washington, John Adams, John Madison all issued proclamation regarding the holiday. Gimbel's department store in Philadelphia was the first major store to host a Thanksgiving Day parade. Yeah, but I can't find that the other article. But it's just, and the amount of effort I was also reading, they would, during this time of year, because obviously we had three of them, they would fill an entire Liberty ship with nothing but Thanksgiving accoutrements, turkeys, cranberry sauce, all the ingredients for the mashed potatoes, everything. So it was vital, you know, all the discomforts in wartime, you know, the two times a year, the Marine Corps as well, but the Army and the Marine Corps, the Allies themselves went whole hog, pardon the pun, on trying to make sure that the guys on the front had something to boost their morale. Apparently it was Thanksgiving and obviously Christmas, but yeah, they went all out as far as getting stuff over there.
Yeah, and you just mentioned something really interesting that puts this whole war in perspective. I mean, you think about what World War II is to everybody, to mm-hmm. every historian, to the novice historian, to us. I mean, look, we have podcasts about this war.
Yep.
We were only involved for 3 Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
That really blows my mind. How much the world changed, how much this country came together. I mean, I was just talking about it earlier today that, you know, we had whatever it was, 7 or 8 aircraft carriers total to be able to be deployed all around planet Earth in 1941, only 4 in the Pacific.
Yeah.
And we estimated we built about 150, 151 during the war. Like, let that sink in. 150 some aircraft carriers were manufactured in a period of time that took less than 4 Thanksgivings.
And you kind of mentioned it earlier. You know, we're talking about how the day after we declared war, now we're worried about Thanksgiving. Imagine, if you would, not that we're getting into an old episode of The Twilight Zone, but imagine if you would, if for some reason we got ourselves into another large-scale debacle where we needed to rely on what American industries we have left manufacturing over here. Obviously, the steel industry's gone, so we wouldn't be manufacturing too many tanks over here. But let's just say for a second, could you imagine trying to go to the Apples, the Microsofts, the Teslas of the world and say, hey, shut down your production, retool, and start building these products of a different, has nothing to do with what you do and is not going to generate you any revenue whatsoever, well, with the exception of government contracts. Do you think they would happily do that in this day and age? Or do you think there'd be a huge, you know, oh, you're overstepping your bounds as the United States government?
Honestly, I think the way we would end up fighting the next war on a grander scale would prevent that from even being an option.
Mm-hmm.
There would be no, you know, it would be a war fought not out of an attrition of materials like that, but of a technological war that would bring a swift devastation.
Yeah.
With the stuff that mass production wouldn't even be a factor. And, and that's just my personal opinion. And what that really does is, say Japan had gotten a hold of the technology that we use for the atomic bombs. Yeah, they couldn't keep up. They couldn't feed their troops. They couldn't keep up with the demands of aircraft or vehicles. They couldn't mass produce like we did. But had they had the technology that we had to create atomic warfare, now it's even Steven. And that's kind of, that should make people pause today. The little guy you picked on the playground may have a secret weapon, and they don't necessarily have to be able to produce like we had to in World War II. Look at our most recent war. Look how they brought us down on their level. Not fighting us at night so much, or not fighting us in the air. They took us down. They put us in their cities on their stomping ground, and they made us fight by their rules. Mm-hmm. And our technology, they'll throw it out the window.
Yeah.
It's an interesting outlook. But back to your point. No, absolutely not. I don't foresee company. I mean, we don't take anything serious enough for long enough to appreciate, that this country, how detrimental it possibly could have been. I mean, look at how many people kind of totally forgot about what happened on September 11th. Really didn't take too long for that not to be front page news anymore. And then,
I mean, I know I don't have to remind you or our audience, but the general everyday counterpart walking down the street, how many of them forgot that we're still at a war right now? It's been going on since 9/11. So, I mean, there you go.
And that's not a modern thing. I mean, how many people were getting sick and tired of the air war in Europe?
Yeah.
You're losing thousands of guys sometimes a week. All right. We got to figure something else out. And, especially the 8th Air Force, they were under the gun. Like, okay, we got to figure this out. And same thing over in Japan. LeMay had to, we need something else to break this kind of, very costly stalemate. Because, the American public, we are fickle. It doesn't take us long to go, okay, that's boring. Tired of that. Okay, what's next? What's the newest, best thing? That's not so much a contemporary outlook for America. I think it's always been like that. It's part of our spirit.
I found that information. Many people believe Abraham Lincoln made the day official in 1863, but he did not. In 1939, the last Thursday happened to be also the last day of the month. Retailers were worried, blah, blah, blah. Nope, that wasn't the information I was looking for. But here's the other thing. I was wrong. I said one Liberty ship. No. Throughout the U.S. involvement overseas, military officials did their best to provide traditional hot holiday meals for soldiers overseas. In 1943, the American people sent two Liberty ships fully stocked with Thanksgiving supplies for their soldiers. Everything was included. Wow. Turkeys, trimming, cranberry sauce, and even various pies. All sent throughout the European and Pacific theater. So that would make sense. One Liberty ship went to Europe. The other one went to the Pacific. All the way to the front lines, those lucky enough to be stationed aboard Navy vessels received excellent food all the time. But Thanksgiving was particularly scrumptious for the servicemen. Despite the good intentions of the higher ranks, every man missed their families, especially during the holidays, but those soldiers had each other through the hardest of times of their lives. However, no Thanksgiving could be quite compared to the ones held at home. Some men observed that the feeling for Thanksgivings was nothing like they could ever at home.
Yeah. There's no place like home.
Yeah. Ain't that the truth? Just to wrap up the Thanksgiving thing, and then we'll get into the Pacific and some anniversaries. Here is a poem that a unidentified soldier wrote during Thanksgiving. I can see everyone eating their dinner deluxe, whether it's chicken, turkey, or even ducks. The fellows over here won't whimper or moan. They'll look to the next one and hope to be home. Truly and honestly, from way down deep, they want you to be happy and enjoy your feast. These holidays are reminders by one and all. Those happy days we can always recall. The ones in the future will be happier, I know, when we can all come back from defeating the foe. And so, I mean, it was just, I don't know, I just couldn't. I could, as bad as the Pacific was hot, and obviously the Battle of Attrition was insane, but above that home is a picture we've all seen of the guy from Fifth Armor laying under his shelter half in a snowy foxhole just biting into a turkey leg. And it's just, I just couldn't even imagine spending a Thanksgiving like that, or two or three, depending on how long you were over there.
Yeah.
And you were
that's an awesome poem, man. You need to put that on our Facebook page. No, that is really cool.
I'll post that tonight. And
yeah,
you were kind of saying earlier that you never really think about it. Three Thanksgivings. Well, that's if you're an old salt in the Marine Corps. I mean, the boys over in Europe, they're lucky they spent one and a half, you know, one. And that's, I don't know, to me, that's the craziest thing about the guys in the Army and the Marine Corps and the Seabees, anyone who served in a Pacific theater operations. If you were one of the guys who, for whatever reason, survived or didn't get enough points, or your position required you to be there from August 7th all the way up until the end of 40 and 45, that's a long run, man.
Yeah. Yeah, very few did that, for sure.
And so you had a topic you wanted to get into a little bit tonight before we get to the interview that we have with Kevin.
Yeah, you know, I mean, try to time when we, when you post these episodes around what was kind of going on in World War II history, you know, so people can kind of appreciate anniversaries. I think it's important, you know, it's important to commemorate certain things, and it's, you know, and it's always kind of, to me, I kind of like to think about anniversaries of things that, you know, that what time of year, the season, you know, try to put yourself in that perspective. And I don't exactly know what day of the month, and I'm sure you could find it, what day Thanksgiving ended up in 1943, but I'm pretty sure it was not before the 20th of November 1943, when, of course, the 2nd Marine Division went in to that goofy-looking little island of, pronounced Batio or Batio or Tarawa, even though there's no such thing as Tarawa, you know, the island, that's the name of the atoll, whatever it was called. It really goes down in history as one of the most pivotal, not just a pivotal battle in the Pacific during World War II, but for the entire Marine Corps.
What day did really, they land?
What's that?
What day did they land?
The 20th of November.
Okay. November 1943, Thanksgiving fell on the 25th. So, I mean, it was...
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so it was on everybody's mind before they even made the landing.
Had to be. You're 5 days out from Thanksgiving. And so, yeah, that's perfect. So there you go. They go in on the 20th, not knowing what's going to happen. This is the first time that the Marines really encountered a hot landing, a hot beach, you know, and it's just the timing of the neap tide, you know, the super low tide of the year, the lowest tide of the year, actually, on the day that they landed. You know, LCVPs are getting hung up on coral reefs, hundreds, sometimes 1,000 yards from the actual shoreline, and being dumped off in the water, you know, wading in if the water was not already over their head. You know, only about 75 of these new Amtraks are available to actually get these guys to the beach. And so putting ourselves back in time, okay, yeah, what are these guys thinking about? I bet you they're like, man, I wonder what mom's cooking for Thanksgiving next week. You know, that's something that people typically probably don't think about. So, you know, we've all heard the story, 76 hours of hell. And, you know, they basically called the island secure on 1300 on the 23rd of November. So about 3.5 days of fighting, but very hard fighting on, you know, this nothing island. But it was essentially an unsinkable aircraft carrier, and it had a runway on it, and it was a good stepping stone for us. And before the island was even secure, I think a Hellcat had landed on it before the mop up was completely done. But so yeah, think about that. And from a personal standpoint, I remember being overseas, just, you know, you try to make a pact with your battle buddies and the guys in your unit that you just don't want to get hit around Christmas.
I want to pause you here real quick, because while you're saying all this very important stuff, I'm just stuck in my tracks here. I just had a thought that never occurred to me, because I've never done this math. You know, you're just saying Saturday. They landed on Saturday, November 20th.
Uh-huh.
We know that the Allies put a tremendous amount of importance, logistics, and expedition into the delivering of their V-mail, right? They got the letters to the boys and the men as quick as they could to keep up morale. But with technology being what it was back then, I'm sure the mothers, the daughters, the girlfriends wrote letters early, perhaps weeks in advance, to try to time this out. How many of those guys landed on that beach who never came back, whose last engagement with their home, the last letter they read was a Thanksgiving letter that arrived early?
Absolutely.
How many of those guys who died on that beach had a Thanksgiving letter in their haversack, in their helmet liner, in that breast pocket? That's just...
I know, man.
I don't even know what you do with that.
It's a whole nother perspective. It's a whole nother perspective looking at that battle and thinking about what you know is on those boys' minds.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what's on all of our minds. It's the holidays. But, of course, in the Central Pacific, you know, November is not fall or winter,
it's summertime.
In the Central Pacific. In the Southern Hemisphere, it's the opposite. Yeah. So it was, as far as I know, it was actually pretty warm that November that they landed. And, but yeah, that's just one of those things. That's our job. That's our duty as people who study history, is to get inside the time. What, you know, surround yourself with the stuff, not that the stuff that comes after that we know, you know, that's the unknown for the guys when November 20th was the present. So what was going on in their little world? You're right. You are absolutely right. How many guys had a Thanksgiving letter? In their haversack, up in their helmet liner, like you said. I mean, that, you are absolutely right. I guarantee there was more than one.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. 5 days before Thanksgiving, you're absolutely right. So, yeah, I just thought that was worth mentioning for our listeners, and maybe hopefully we encouraged our listeners to look a little deeper, you know, go inside these battles and try to think about, like I said, that's why I think it's important to commemorate things on their anniversaries, because then you kind of get a feel for, you know, that time of year and what's going on. You know, things haven't changed. People are Christmas shopping in late November. They always have been.
Yeah.
Obviously, you talked about it with what FDR went through. So, yeah, I mean, that's the human experience.
And the thing about Christmas, at least in the European theater, Christmas was not only was an important holiday, but for whatever reason, the planners, the logistics officers, or maybe just the brass down near the battlefields, for some reason, they always used Christmas as the movable goalpost. It was always like, hey, we're going to be done by Christmas this year. And then they moved it, and they're still there next year. And then, you know, the next year, oh, we're going to be done by Christmas this year. And so Christmas was always hard to even fathom, too. One, because of the weather, but two, the fact that they're always promised, oh, we'll be done before Christmas. And wasn't the case.
Yeah.
And as,
yeah, and that goes back to what I was saying before, is, you know, you don't, holidays are sometimes hard for people who've lost family members and everything. You know, it's a time of reflection and deep thought sometimes. And yeah, you didn't want to get it. You didn't want to buy the farm around Christmas. You didn't want to do that to your mom. You didn't want to do that to your family. And, you know, think about these guys on Tarawa with that Thanksgiving letter in their haversack that didn't come home. When do you think their mom got that telegram?
Months
probably
later.
Before Christmas.
Yeah. Well, if they're lucky. We all know how the grave registration went in the Pacific. I don't mean to laugh, but yeah.
No, seriously. I mean, the newspaper said that island was secure. You know, I mean, you know, people are waiting.
Yeah.
So, but when do you break the news to them? You know, it probably was probably around Christmas, if not a little before, not far after. And that's tough. That's tough.
Yeah, that battle was just so intense. I mean, they had everything going against them. Like you said, the nape tide. Once they got on the beach, there was nowhere to go. They're stuck underneath the pier for the longest time. It's just, that was, logistically, the whole thing was just insane. I mean, you're talking, you know, I'm looking at the numbers here. I'm trying to figure out which side is Japanese, which, okay, yeah, 1,696 killed, 2,101 wounded. U.S. Marine Corps, 1,000 killed, 2,101 wounded. U.S. Navy, one escort carrier sank, 687 killed. And that's, you know, that's not even including the Japanese losses.
And that escort carrier, I believe, was the Liskin Bay.
Yep, sure was. Was the USS Liskin Bay, which was an ACV, CVE-56, was the second of the 50 Casablanca-class escort carriers built to serve the United States Navy during World War II, launched on April 1943. So that thing had a very short shelf life on it.
And it it took one very famous sailor down with it. You know, the very first African-American there in the Navy Cross, Dory Miller, from his exploits at Pearl Harbor, went down with the Liskin Bay.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. Times like this, I mean, and you know, because you served, the holidays, it's just in itself. I mean, it's just one more thing to make you think about home. And I would assume a lot of times when you're over there, the last thing you want to do is, you know, torture yourself by thinking about things you can't have really any real control over.
Yeah, but you just can't help it sometimes. You let your mind wander sometimes.
So anything going on down at the museum?
Yeah, so, you know, speaking of anniversaries and commemorations, we're going to be celebrating on the 5th of December, you know, this next coming Saturday. The Highland Lake Squadron is going to host a Pearl Harbor commemoration and salute to first responders program. So I think it's a neat way to tie in. We don't exactly have any Pearl Harbor, you know, artifacts.
Sure.
You know, a direct tie to Pearl Harbor. I'm going to bring an artifact or two from my personal collection to display, but we don't really have anything in the collection. So I thought this is a great way to tie it in with first responders. I mean, think about immediately after the attack, everybody was a first responder. Everybody had to help, you know, the bucket brigades and helping with casualties and everything. So we're going to have some of the local fire departments and police and EMS. We're going to, you know, cook some pork butts and sausage and some sides, and the VFW is going to make some desserts. And we got the SNJ airworthy again. So we'll be hopefully selling some rides in the SNJ. And we're going to top the day off with, we've got a projection screen coming in, and we're going to show Tora 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 in the hangar on a big projection screen.
That's cool. You know, that's one of the things I enjoy doing. It doesn't happen all the time, but a few of the Florida reenacting events, there's a gentleman who has like a, I don't know, it's like a 15-foot utility trailer. It's all white, and he just sets up a projector, and after the public goes home and we're all sitting around trying to figure out what we're going to do for 4 hours before we go to bed, after we eat or something, he'll project a, you know, movie, whether it's Fury or I think the first time I saw the original version of Catch 22 was on the side of that trailer. And it's kind of it's interesting when you're sitting around watching those movies and you look around, and yes, we're at a reenactment event, but you know, you're sitting, you know, an hour and a half into Fury or whatever movie, and as you look around, there's guys wearing those same uniforms watching the movie. It's almost kind of like when you're watching Band of Brothers and they're all sitting there watching Casablanca and you know, right, they're all just sitting there in their uniforms. It's just, I don't know, it's just a little, sometimes it can be a little, just, I don't know,
just, that's part of the experience. I mean,
yeah,
that's important. That's important. I mean, if you really try to keep it to period movies, it really takes it another step deeper. But yeah, man, I appreciate you as a reenactor, and you know, like I said, that's why we got to do this and do it for these guys that didn't come home, and their moms that you know, got that telegram around Thanksgiving, Christmas. I mean, any time is tough. You know, war's tough, man. War, it's always been tough, but there's little nuances that can make it just a little bit tougher. So I think it's our duty to make sure that that's just, and it just can't be forgotten, you know.
And it being Thanksgiving Day weekend, I just want to say I'm thankful for all the listeners who's been supporting this show for going on 3 years now. If you guys want a sticker, email us. They're free. Email us info@ WTSPWorldWar2.com or mail call at WTSPWorldWar2.com or get our Facebook page. Send us a message. Send me your name, address, and the color you want. That's right. If you have a black truck, or if you're the type of guy who likes to do the black on black with your tinted windows, that's fine. If you have a red truck and you want a red sticker, you have a green truck, you want a green sticker, whatever. If you want a bright pink sticker so the thing can be seen miles away, just send us an email at info@wtspworldwar2.com, and we'll send out some stickers your way. I want to send you out some more, Jeff. I got to get some. I got some here that are cut. I got to have my daughter peel out. It's an operation. I cut them with the Krig, and then I give them to her to peel out. And so we want to get those sent out to everybody. And as always, if you haven't done so, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the Patreon link and sign up. It's $1 a month. We're actually getting ready here. I was hoping to get it done here shortly, but my computer that I pipe the co-host of the What's in Your Head podcast in through Zoom is decided to go rogue, and it's at 22% updating. So I don't know. I was hoping to have Jeff on tonight, but we'll see with time on that. I don't know how longer that's going to take. But as always, the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast is brought to you by our friends at At Computers. At Computers has been providing IT solutions for all Southwest Florida since 2004. So even if you don't live in Southwest Florida, give them a call. They can log in your computer. Obviously, your internet needs to work. And you say, well, no, obviously. Well, I've had calls. People say, hey, my internet's down. Can you log in my computer? Take a look. No, I cannot. But if your internet's working and you want us to help out with your computer problems, give them a call at 239-283-1120. If you need some help with two-form authentication, antivirus protection, most importantly, online backup. Back up all your data safe to the cloud in case your computer crashes, something happens to your computer. Hard drives nowadays, I think they're good for about 3 years at most. So make sure that important data is backed up. It's super cheap. It's 7 cents a gig per month. Give them a call, 239-283-1120. And as always, thank you guys for everything. And by the way, congratulations to our friend RJ Nevins and company. The Walking Point is just racking up the awards at all these independent film festivals. And now that people are starting to figure out a way to have these events and still do the COVID, you know, restrictions and all that, they're starting to happen more regularly now. And they're just cleaning up in the awards department, right?
Yeah, man. It's awesome. It was like Film of the Year. You got Director of the Year at the North Virginia Film Fest up in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm like, my gosh,
Been 2 years since they started filming?
Let's see. We wrapped. When was that? March?
Yeah, because I saw a post from
of 18.
Because K9 Duke posted on his Instagram page. It's been 2 years ago since they first met you.
Yeah, that was. It had to have been a little more than that. Yeah, because I met them in the summer, like July of 18. July of 17, I think. And then, I met him in 18. We started filming February and wrapped in the end of March, somewhere in there.
Yep.
And, has it been 2 years? I guess. It's all running together.
Yeah, the older you get, the quicker time goes by. And that's even more important why you need to, focus on the holidays and all that stuff. It's just... At the end of the day, man.
Has that been three Thanksgivings ago now? Wow.
Yeah, three Thanksgivings a day ago. Real quick. Man, we're getting old. You're talking about pulling something cool out of your collection to take over to the museum for this event. What is one of your, I don't know if we've ever talked about this. What is currently, because I know obviously these things change depending on when you find new cool things, but what is currently your prized possession in your collection?
Oh boy.
It don't have to be your prize. Maybe the one that just flips your light switch right now. When someone comes over your house, like, oh, and they see something, they're like, oh wait, you got to see this.
Okay. Yeah. It's probably going to be the artifact that I mentioned. It's about a 1/100th scale scratch built model of the Arizona. It's a little over 6 feet long. It's all completely custom, scratch built, and actually came out of Malcolm Forbes' toy boat collection. Malcolm Forbes being the Forbes, from Forbes magazine. Apparently, he was a big antique toy boat collector, and his collection ranged from the 1880s to the 1940s, and they were very specific. Scratch built toy boats. This is not, this is before you had the Revell Arizona kit in plastic.
Right.
And it was never completed. There's some of the details a little bit more bare on one side of the ship than the other, but it was just something my grandfather had gotten a hold of and has since been passed down to me. And it's, I mean, for just being scratch built, just balsa wood and cardboard, you know, painted gray, it is really incredible. In fact, I'll send you some pictures if you want.
Yeah, I saw one or two, but yeah,
please near to me.
Yeah, please send some photos so we can put up on the website and the Facebook page.
Yeah, that's definitely different than the Arizona model you saw on social today.
Okay. What is the medium that's made out of? Is it wood? Is it plaster Paris? Is it, you know, what's it made from?
The one you saw today?
No, the one that you have in your personal collection.
No, the one I have is it's almost all balsa wood.
Okay.
Yeah, and there's some kind of metal tubing that he used for the main guns, but everything else is, it's all wood. It's incredible. So, yeah, I'll take some pictures, and I'll actually take a picture of the inside because you can pull off the whole superstructure and look on the inside of the hull and see.
Nice.
Got a lot of the ribbing and the propeller spin and everything.
It's so, you know, a lot of cool stuff came out of the times back then, even if it was from the 50s and 60s, because people, woodworking was an art back then. Not only was it a craft, not only was it something you could do, take, you know, as a living, but it was a popular hobby back then. And, you know,
true,
if you had the wood making skills and you had an interest, it, a lot of times, you know, it happened all the time, whether it's a plane, a Navy vessel, a train. People took what, doll houses were huge because dads would build them for their daughters using their woodworking passions. And so you would see a lot of that cool stuff come out of back then. Nowadays, here's your store-bought tank that I glued together with some glue and some, put some water decals on. Here you go. But
yeah,
it's, have you seen, before we wrap up, I want to give my Netflix suggestion of the episode. Have you seen Liberator yet?
I haven't. I've had a few guys tell me about it, and I've heard nothing but good things, but I have not seen it.
I was watching the first episode. Mike Rowe does the opening monologue. Why he doesn't narrate the whole series, 12 episodes, I don't know, but he does the opening monologue. And I'm like watching it, and I'm like, this sounds awfully familiar. And then a light switch went off, and I realized I had the book in here that I just read a few months back. But it's very, very cool. It's animated, but it's, this may be a little before your time, Jeff. Do you remember the original Lord of the Rings from the 70s?
Negative.
Okay, the original Lord of the Rings, the key characters were drawn just like a Disney. But like some of the orcs and all that, they would film live action and then they would overlay them with animation so that they can get the proper movements. Well, this is done just kind of that way. There's a real cast and crew. But obviously, to save production money, instead of having all these huge sound stages and all that, they would animate the background stuff. And so sometimes you can see like how they had put black tape on their uniforms and to simulate the sketching. But basically, what they did is they got real actors, put them on a sound stage. They would, you know, have the uniforms on, and then they would put animation over top of them to make it look like they were comic book almost. But it's done very well. The acting's great in it. The dialogue's awesome. It's very cool because it's a different take on the European, because it's about the Thunderbirds travels through Italy and all the way around to when they go and find some of the first concentration camps. But it's very well done. The acting's great. I was watching it one time. I was like, yeah, I think that actor was using a Denix Thompson there because it's the same one I have. It's the M1928, but it doesn't have the cuts compensator on it. So I mean, there's little things you can tell when they're doing their props and then they did the overlay. But it was very well done. So if you guys haven't checked that out, it's like, I don't know, 8 episodes long. It's very cool. Check it out. I think it was like trending 3rd and on Netflix a while back. But, I mean, it's been a while. Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't get to see Greyhound because I was on Disney Plus, but it's been a while since we've had a newer World War II movie or series come out. So definitely check that one out if you haven't seen Liberator yet. I think your kids will dig it. But hey, that's going to wrap it up for the intro of this episode. We're going to go into an interview I did back with the World War II reenactor. He does German, believe it or not. It's our second German interview. And so we're going to get into that from the, I think it was Largo. No, Vero Beach Gun Show a few months back. Interestingly enough, they got an event coming up in December, actually next weekend. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make it. I got basically 2 events left in this World War II reenacting season. The one in Vero Beach, there is one in Alabama. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make that one this year. So I'm not counting that one. And then the one in Georgia, which is a 2-day tactical event. So But yeah, my season's winding down here because, well, just like everybody else listening, COVID knocked out your seasons. But anyhow, Jeff, thank you so much. And as always, where can people find you on the social media?
Yeah, just Jeff Copsetta or at Jeff Copsetta on Instagram. And, of course, they can go through our What's the Scuttlebutt Facebook page as well. Just, you know, ask us a question. And yeah.
Please do that. Send us an email.
Everybody that listens.
Yeah, please do that. Send us an email, mailcall@WTSPWorldWar2.com or info@WTSP. Even if not meant to be on air, if you have a suggestion, hey, you guys have yet to talk about this, it may not be something that we're familiar with. We may say, hey, if you know a lot on it, are you interested in coming on the show and contributing? Or B, we may look up and do some research on it and talk about it. But yeah, that too, if you're interested in coming on the show, you know, part of the reason we like to interview reenactors and all that is who knows best about this other than scholars, you know, to help share this history. So if there's a topic that you're interested in, you think maybe you can maintain a conversation for 30, 40 minutes, send us an email, info@WTSPWorldWar2.com, or hit us up on Facebook. You can hit me up on Instagram, and we'll figure something out. But thank you guys so much, and here we go with Kevin.
And we are back, and joining us now is Mr. Kevin Crane. Kevin, how are you doing tonight, sir?
Tired, but enjoyed a good week this weekend. Had a fun time.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the logistical mistakes I always make when I do these podcasts at an event. Is obviously I want to do it after at least the first day, so we can talk about how the event went or things like that. But usually everybody's just so tired, and a lot of times myself, I'm so tired that I'll leave an event and not even do a show because it's just, you know, you saw me out there earlier. I was sitting by the fire and I was dozing off, and I ended up having to make a pot of coffee.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I also wanted to tell you to get up and go lie on the cot if you were that tired.
Yeah, so I made a pot of coffee, and, well, I didn't want to go to bed because at 42, my back is only good for about 4 hours on the ground.
I read you.
And I know if I went to bed at 8 o'clock, I'd be up at 3 in the morning. What now?
Right.
So I made a pot of coffee, and here we are, and we are good to go. So, Kevin, just... One thing I like to do when I interview living historians for the audience of this podcast who don't participate in this hobby is get a little background on people so that after a while people get a feel of how not living historians are completely different in their daily lives. One guy may be a computer guy, one guy may be a doctor, one guy may be a police officer, one guy may, you know, who knows what. So what do you do in your daily life, Kevin?
I run a company called Buccaneer Tiki Huts. I build and thatch thatch tiki huts of all shapes and sizes, and I also do decks, bars, and tree houses.
Now, when you do tiki huts, obviously most people know that tiki huts are usually made from palm fronds and things
Correct.
Like that. Where do you harvest and where do you get your palm fronds from?
Basically, there's a town west of where I live that yields pretty good results out in Palm City. But I've got them in Jupiter, I've got them in Vero. It all depends on a given job, but you just need to drive, you know, out into the west where things are a little bit less populated, and they grow along the sides of the roads, or there's a lot of property, of real estate, property for sale that you can cut on. And as long as you don't ignore any trespassing signs or jump any fences, the police have, in 20 years, I've never been hassled while I've been out cutting leaves.
And that's kind of a nice business model because that keeps your overhead down.
It's Correct.
When you're using supplies that, obviously, your 2x4s and things like that, you got to pay, you know, you got to buy the lumber for that. But when you're doing tiki huts, and, you know, it's not like shingle and roof where you got to go out and buy the shingles and then mark it up. So it keeps your margins, well, your margins higher, your overhead lower. What's the longevity of a normal natural palm frond? How long are they good for up on a roof?
If the weather's reasonably good, I would say you'd get 5 to 6 years. Depending, unless you're on, the closer you are to the water, it's marginally lower because of the winds involved. But, you know, your average residential tiki in some backyard, unless there's really serious severe weather, you should get good 5 years out of it.
Speaking of severe weather, the wind's picking up a little bit, the microphone's picking up, but that's not a big deal. Now, are palm fronds, are they naturally mildew resistant? As far as all that goes? Or do you just have them at enough of a rake?
It's the repetition.
Sunlight?
You literally lay so many leaves over each other that it just creates a barrier that water can't get through. Because, I think about what you're saying about them being naturally water resistant, but as soon as the leaves have been up there for a couple of weeks, they die.
Yeah.
So it's more or less due to the repetition of layers that are put on the hut. That has a great deal to do with it.
What got you involved in reenacting?
Let's see. I started collecting military antiques when I was very young, probably about the age of 13, 14 years old. And this was in the late 70s, and I think I was headed into freshman year of high school. And I dealt with a lot of Army-Navy surplus stores that back then, Seoul, you could find original German memorabilia at these places. So anyway, the store owner where I did my shopping there for my military antiques one day asked me if I'd ever heard of reenacting, and she gave me the phone number of who later turned out to be my my unit commander, and that's George Krupa. And this would have been, I went to my first, there were no reproductions back then, so you had to go full original, pretty much.
And with your height and your stature, that's probably a little easier for you. If you want to go ahead and open up that drink, you can. That way, you can get your throat settled down and your Coke's not getting hot in the Florida heat. We're not too worried about it. I mean, I'm sitting here drinking as we go, and so we're good to go.
Anyway, just to wind this up, when I started to approach the reenacting, I already had almost all the stuff I needed because I was already a collector. I already had all the field gear and the uniforms or something, but I was collecting it as military antiques. Well, that suddenly became my reenacting gear for the next 3 years. And I did events. I went to my first event in February at a very famous place up north most reenactors know of, called Rockford. We were the first unit to go in there. That was February 17th, 1977, 2 years before my 15th birthday.
That's insane. And obviously, and Brian and I were just talking about part of the problem with reenacting nowadays and is the barrier to entry, which is why so many reenactors are older, is because of the financial involvement. Whereas, like you're saying, back then, the stuff was, more readily available, the price points were lower, and with your size and stature, you could easily get into those uniforms. And so to get into this at 15, especially back then, that's quite an achievement.
Well, like I said, I was lucky because I'd already, as a military collector, even at that young age, I already had almost all my field gear, pieces of my uniform, helmets, everything that I needed. Probably I would say about 80%, and I had to get I had my unit commander help me get a couple extra things. I think I bought a pair of boots and some Y straps and stuff, and I was good to go. So I think that I was lucky to have been in the position I was in as a collector, because it made my transition into the reenacting very quickly. It wasn't like I decided I wanted to get involved in it, and it took a while. 2 months later, I went into the field. 3 feet of snow in February.
Now, obviously, you were saying up north, and now you're just saying 3 feet of snow in February. What state were you? What state did you?
I was in Rockford, Illinois.
Illinois.
Rockford is a huge reenactment now, but back then nobody had ever heard of it. We were the first unit to go in there. Representing a private infantryman in Hare. Unit called the 110th Panzer Regiment, and which is their parent unit, or their parent division is the 11th Panzer Division, and we were up against they're not even around anymore, the Devil's Brigade, at that Rockford event.
Hold on one second, my mic cord is freaking out and it's bleeding over what you're saying. I don't want to diminish your comments by poor audio quality. It almost sounds like wind, but there we go. And so you're saying Rockford, at the time,
nobody'd ever heard of it.
And
now it's, I'm sure you know Rockford, right?
No, really. I didn't get involved in reenacting until I moved to Florida. So I missed out. Even when I lived in Ohio, I was just talking to Brian about this. I never experienced Conneaut. That's still on my bucket list. And so I don't, with the exception of the event I did in Alabama and Georgia, I don't know reenacting.
It's become a huge event.
Yeah.
I've never actually been to it, but we were the first unit to go in there back 40-odd years ago, and now they have a huge reenactment there every year. I don't think it's in the exact same place that we use, though, the same area.
Now, when you do your German impression, which is your only impression, what regiment or what group do you usually portray?
My primary impression, before all the other ones, is a member of the 9th Hohenstaufen Division, which is an SS division, a Waffen-SS division, which is not to be confused with the Allgemeine SS. They were the ones who guarded the camp. The Waffen-SS that I serve as a soldier in a unit of was an armed unit that fought alongside the regular soldiers in the army in most cases. So I portray a sergeant in the 9th Hohenstaufen Division, and let's see, to give you a little bit better background, we were one of the divisions that fought at Arnhem with the British when they tried to do Bridge Too Far, and our division was praised by the British, who were actually taken prisoner by our units, that they were treated very reasonably and decently, and their wounded were attended to. So the Waffen-SS, just like all branches of it, has got bloodstains on it, but not every single unit or every single soldier was involved in places like Malmedy or Wurlamont or even the Warsaw Uprising and what happened with Derlanger. So anyway, that's my primary, is a Scharfuhrer in the 9th Hohenstaufen Division, circa fall of 1944. My second impression is that of a soldier in the German Africa Corps, serving in North Africa. Excuse me.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you that, because I noticed you do have some of the North African HBT uniforms.
Yeah, I'm wearing my African uniforms right now. I've been wearing it all day. Yes,
because it makes perfect sense down here in Florida.
So anyway, that's a soldier of the Africa Corps under Rommel, and growing up, we were always seeing movies about the armies fighting in the desert, chasing each other about, and just it's become a very romanticized part of the war, even though in reality it was just as awful as anywhere else.
Sure.
But so anyway, my next impression after that is Heer, which is regular German army. I serve as a sergeant in the 59th Fusilier Battalion. We are a bike regiment who, oddly enough, also served near the area where Bridge Too Far took place in that battle for Arnhem. Tiger commander. Even though I don't have
Where's
a tank.
Your tank?
No, but I do have the impression the tanker's uniform. And if I'm lucky enough, sometime soon here, when Rob brings his tanks out, I'll get to have my pictures taken with him, and I'll be able to justify the impression.
Yeah, that'd be a nice addition to your portfolio of photos. Now, we're here at the Vero Beach Gun Show, and this weekend is just kind of a quick put-together living history event because, well, much like everybody else in the country, due to COVID, all our events were shut down, and plus it's middle of the summer, which we try to do most of our stuff in the wintertime because of the heat and the environment. But I guess you guys have been doing events here for years, and the big one's coming up December 1st, where we actually will do a battle reenactment. And I guess in the past, you guys are talking about you've had everything from people parachuting into here and just all kinds of...
Politicians here and huge, huge crowds, hundreds and hundreds of people. Yeah, the trouble was there at the same time that we used the park, there was a dog show being held here. And for 2 years, the dog show people complained that the blanks from the battle were upsetting the dogs, which I respect as a dog owner. So they... we ended up for a year not being...
I do apologize. I got to get a new microphone cable. As you're talking, the static is just crazy.
Do you need me to back up?
No, it's just...
Oh, okay.
This cable has a short end and it's just going ape shit.
Will you be able to edit this out?
Yeah, I'll just...
The dead space, I mean?
Yeah. I can edit all this out.
How am I doing with this, okay?
You're fine. You're perfect. Okay. Only problem we're having is this stupid microphone cable, which I got to replace. See, this is my computer. I actually have a studio set up in my house, and I only use this equipment when I do events, and it's been a while. And so, as you're saying, the problem was is you guys are doing this the same weekend of a dog show, and the dogs, and rightfully so, depending on the
correct
size
dog
of the
dog. I know my dog does not like gunfire, so I appreciate what they were saying, but the park's the ones who scheduled us here at this particular time. That wasn't our idea. So Hey, it's no fault. Anyway, in any event, then 1 year we couldn't really have any battle or any weapons demo, and then the following year, last year, they changed the date on it. So we were able to do all that again, and now I think it will start to go back to what it used to be, which is a much, much larger event.
As someone who's been doing living history and reenacting as long as you have, you're probably one of the few people on this show who's been doing it for that a length of time. Where do you see reenacting now, and does it have ebb and flow? I mean, for example, I used to skateboard, and I know it would go in 10-year cycles. It'd gain popularity, then it would die down, gain popularity and die down. Where do you feel it's at now, and what are some of the changes for good and some of the changes for bad you've seen over the last, 25, 30 years?
40 years.
40 years,
actually,
yeah,
40 years.
Yeah, I was born in 78, I'm 42, so yeah, 40 years.
Yeah, because I left the hobby for a great many years. I did it for three and a half, four years, and then I left the hobby for a long time. And for years, I thought that I would have to come back to, in order to get back into the hobby, I'd have to start recollecting German war memorabilia again and gear in order to furnish my impression. And that cost of the prices have skyrocketed. It's not that easy anymore to even find the stuff like it used to be. Anyhow, I ran across a company in Columbia, Kentucky called At the Front.
Mm-hmm.
And realized that all the stuff that I needed could be purchased as reproductions that were as good a quality, if not sometimes you could even confuse them with the real thing. So the quality of some of the companies in Asia, here in the States, everywhere, it's frightening. You could fool somebody sometimes into thinking you're actually looking at the real thing. Anyhow,
not to cut you off, and while we're on the subject of that, and I know you're probably similar to I am, this weekend we're doing a living history event, so I brought out my original haversacks, my original M1 belts. When you're out in the field, running around, rolling, getting dirty, and a lot of the guys, we don't like to, unless it's one of those pieces of equipment that are still a dime a dozen, but the majority of us, we don't appreciate or enjoy going out and doing tactical events or reenactments wearing original gear, because it's just so hard on it that most of us wear our reproduction gear at that time. And so it's definitely nice now that you, like you said, you have At the Front, World War II Impressions.
Yeah, Hessian Antique, International Military Antique, Southwest Military Wholesale. There's a dozen companies in the United States that cater to our hobby. And they all try and come up with the closest quality item to the original as they possibly can. And it's quite a competition, and it drives the price up, and it is not a cheap thing to be in this hobby these days.
One of the things I recommend to people who are wanting to get into this is if you have the ability, sometimes you can go onto these websites and they'll have used equipment for sale, and the price is lower. And don't be afraid to buy used equipment, because what's going to happen is you're going to buy that brand new equipment and someone's going to see a photo, oh, your uniform's too clean, you need to weather it. And so by all means, if you can find quality used equipment, reproduction equipment, that's already, dirty, and you save 20, 30 bucks, by all means, buy the used stuff. If it fits you and it looks good on you, save the money, buy the used stuff, because it's going to already have that wear and tear look to it. And so, what are some of the downsides, some of the negative changes you've seen in this hobby over the last 10 years or so?
Back when I first got into this hobby, you didn't see, at least in the unit I served in, you didn't see any reproductions. They weren't available, the companies weren't out there and stuff. I mean, you saw things, but a lot of times they were labeled, a word we reenactors use, they call it farb, which means it bears no relation to the actual item, and it's fake. It doesn't look anything like an original. And it can refer to anything, to a helmet, to a pair of boots, to a bob. It's just a universal word.
Yeah, I believe it's a shortened version of far be it from me, but...
it has to do with the lack of... Actually, it's a German word, and it
really
has to do with the lack of color.
Huh.
So, I don't... All I know is it's been used for years, back when I first got in the hobby. Anyway,
downside changes you've seen?
Oh yeah, is that the guys all arguing and argue over whose stuff is best in the reproduction world? That I buy my stuff from one company and they're way better than the one you just mentioned, and their helmet looks farb, or their ammo pouches look farb, mm-hmm. and so there's a lot of.
Well, the internet's made all that worse, because I find out, regardless if it's World War II or if you join a parrot group because you got three parrots and you want to make sure you're doing it right, what happens is when you have a group of people who aren't interacting in person, it becomes less about helping people out and more about who knows the most. It's just a bunch of people trying to outdo one another in the knowledge of whatever that particular subject may be. Like, once again, whether it's parrots, Boston Terriers or World War II. And so a lot of times you go there with hopes and desires to learn something and to get constructive criticism, and it's just a bunch of people trying to prove who knows more about that particular topic than anybody else, and it becomes just a negative waste of time.
Yeah, I would say to anybody entering, a young person especially entering the hobbies these days, is you're just going to have to develop your own trial and error system when it comes to a lot of these companies, because you can jump on Facebook and you can say, "Oh, I want to buy a set of ammo pouches from the Smith Company," and you'll get 10 different replies, and arguments will start over the quality of what's on there and stuff, and at the end, you're not getting any kind of a clearer picture of what did you wanted to find out in the first place, which is, should I buy this item from this company? Is it quality? So sometimes you just got to kind of wade into it on your own. You buy, that's how I did it. I bought several things from some of the top companies, and I learned what their strong points were in their inventories or their low points. And I let that act as my guide. And unfortunately, sometimes it can cost you a little bit of money. You know, there's one company I checked out by buying several military caps from them. And unfortunately, they were so bad, I just had to eat the loss, and I literally gave the caps away. But I know now never to ever go to that company for that particular item again. So,
as somebody who's been doing German reenacting and living history as long as you have, obviously there's some stigma that comes along with it.
Oh, heck yeah.
What is some of the, just the incessant things that you just run into over and over again when it comes to when someone may meet you for the first time and find out what you do, or see a photo of you somewhere in a uniform and seeing the swastika on your breast because that was the logo? What's some of the hardest parts about being a German reenactor in general, and has it changed? Has those problems become more now that we're 2020 and everybody are so sensitive to compare to what it was like in 1980 when you're doing it?
No, actually, it's less, ironically. When I first started reenacting in early 77, the reenacting as a hobby was nowhere near as well known as it is now. I mean, now it's universal. I know reenactors all over the world, literally. Guys in Japan, guys in India and stuff like that. Anyhow, so back then, it happened to me. We would go and we would have an event where our unit would go to a museum and set up, a lot like we are this weekend at this gun show. And sometimes we might skirmish with the Americans and shoot off some blanks. So everybody would applaud the Americans for being there, but beyond that, since nobody had really... reenacting as a hobby had not been around that long then, people looked at us and just went, "What the F are the Nazis doing here?"
Well, and we also got to keep in mind, this is 1977, so you're only 30, you know, a handful of years outside the war, and the people who were there, or the children of the people there.
But they didn't understand. They would see us at an event in the uniforms and have no concept of reenacting, and they would immediately jump to the political fourth right and so forth like that. So anyway, nowadays I do a particularly harsh impression as a Waffen SS soldier. It's subject to a lot of controversy because the SS were involved in a lot of atrocities, whether it was the Allgemeine SS in the camp or the Waffen-SS at Malmedy or Warlemont or the Warsaw Uprising. But I have never, in the last 8 years that I've been in the hobby doing this, I've yet to have anybody come up and say anything negative to me. I always get compliments. And I tell people the reason I'm here is to show people the truth of what things looked like back then, the uniforms, the vehicles. It's simply a combat a history impression, and that's it.
You may know the answer to this more than I do. I know, I don't know if it ever came to fruition, but I know there was talks three and a half, four years ago that over in Europe, they were trying to float the idea of, hey, at reenacting, you guys can't have the swastikas on your uniforms and this and that and the other thing. And there were, and you're, that's, and I get it. I get what that logo means to a lot of the people over there. But once again, you're erasing history, and we're not out there doing living history events or reenactments to romanticize war, to make it seem like this big great thing. No, we're, on the contrary, we're doing it to celebrate the work and energy that the Allies and the Americans put into it. We're also trying to tell the entire story for what it is, good, bad, the ugly. And more importantly, especially when it comes to some of the atrocities in which you spoke of, if you don't teach those histories, people are going to forget it. And there used to be a saying, back even when I was growing up, if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it. That seems to be, well, let's just get rid of everything now. And one of the things I, with what's going on in our country now with the Civil War, statues being torn down, look, not every monument is a celebration. Do you think the Germany looks at Auschwitz Museum as a celebration? No. It's a stern reminder of what happens when things can go bad. Yes, some monuments are celebrations, but not a lot of them are not a celebration. It's a reminder. And I always joke around, and like when it comes to some of this Civil War stuff that's being taken down. Look, if you truly believe that the particular person and that monument that you're wanting torn down is a horrible person, instead of turning down a statue, why not put up a plaque saying, hey, here's so-and-so, this guy was an asshole, let's not do this again. And so the idea of over there to have reenactments where now we're removing logos and badges from uniforms where now they're just a generic boogeyman, there's no justice in history on that.
No, I agree with you. And I don't think it should be done. And I'm sorry that certain things are offensive to certain people. And I am not disrespecting that can be the case. But when it comes to trying to show history literally, which is what we're here to do especially.
Yes.
We're supposed to show the difference between what you see in Hollywood, what comes out of Hollywood, and what the Allied and Axis armies during World War II actually looked like. So we don't get to remove and pick and choose and what we do or don't want on the uniforms. We are presenting the images as they were 75 odd years ago, and they should remain intact, not cherry picked of things people don't like to look at. I'm sorry.
And as Brian and I were talking before, there is an unspoken decorum. You're not going to have people walking around dressed up like Goebbels or Himmler or Hitler.
No, and I won't personally, I won't allow the swastika to be flown on anything. That, I mean, it might be stamped on a box, but if somebody were to put up a German flag, the big red flag or something, I'd be the first person to tell them to take it down. Because regardless of what I said earlier, I do not want to directly offend anybody who comes to visit us. And flags like that are political, a lot of them. The real Germans didn't fly battle flags in front of their, with the swastika on them, in their little defenses like this.
Yeah.
They would have used unit flags. So I don't see any reason to let that, to even go there. You know, we don't need to have flags, and they're going to cost, and I feel that, a big giant red swastika flag, it could be offensive to some people. There's no reason for us to have them here.
Yeah, so there's a difference from the crest on your uniform versus a
correct
propaganda.
In your face.
Yeah,
I don't. We have no desire to alienate people here. We're here to try and help educate them.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. What are some of the positive things you've seen as far as reenacting in the last couple of years? Are things bouncing back? Are they stabilizing? Are the people getting involved? Do you find that they try to learn the history more? Or, you know, what are some of the positive things you've seen over the last couple of years?
I would say that the people that I've met in reenacting, and this goes back all the way to when I started in the 70s until now to tonight here, are probably some of the finest people I meet in life. I consider this my extended family, and it just so happens that some of the best people I've ever met happen to be reenactors. They're among my friends. They're the people that I actually hang out with even when we don't go to reenactments. And it's because it does, for some reason, it seems to attract, not every single time, but more or less a higher caliber of person to our ranks.
Now, obviously, there's always the exception that proves that rule, but I couldn't agree with you more. It's funny. I was talking to my fiance tonight, and my battery on my cell phone was dying, and I was in my truck trying to charge it. And I was like, well, I have a wall charger. Let me go plug it up in the pavilion. She's like, well, aren't you afraid someone's going to steal your phone? I said, no, the public's gone.
Right.
I said, I've yet to meet a I said, everybody out here has thousands of dollars worth of equipment.
Yep.
I said, I've been in charge of a gentleman's $5,000 Browning automatic rifle. He just put it in my hands, and I've been in charge. I said, there's no one here that's going to feel the desire to steal my $700 phone.
No.
And like you said, we're all great friends. If you've been to at least three events in the same state, you're going to know the people.
Yes.
And the people who are assholes, they get drummed out.
Yep, they do quick.
One mess up, you know, you'll hear a story that may have happened 10 years ago where one person stole someone's item. They were drummed out. And we're self-policing. We all have so much invested in this hobby that, you know, it's hard to have the amount of money invested in this hobby and be a dirtball. It just don't go hand in hand, because usually dirtballs are not only dirtballs in that time, but they're dirtballs in our daily life. And so usually they don't get to a position where they can afford the type of equipment to be here.
Sure.
And so I don't, you know, and when the public's here, hey, Kevin, I got to use the restroom. Can you keep an eye on my camp? And everybody does that. You know, you got to walk away from your camp to go do something. The guy in the tent next to you will keep an eye on your stuff. And if somebody walks up to your stuff, he will treat it like it's his and talk to them and make sure no one walks up to your stuff. And it's a very nice communal thing. And that's one of the best things about living history is, one, we get to sit around campfires and usually not be on our phones. And two, we're all trustworthy, nice people out here.
One short story I'd like to share with
sure.
you just real quick to show you the bonds that we have among us is I have a young Jack Russell mix that I bring to mm-hmm. most of these events. She's here with us this weekend. And I went to an event in a place called Markets of Marion 2 years ago, and River was with us, and there were some tanks there. And I, of course, had to leave her on an extended leash in camp while I went to the battlefield to perform in the event. Well, little known to me, while I was gone, when the tanks started firing their shells, River got so freaked out and so scared that she broke her leash, broke the rope of her leash and took off. And we're miles from hundreds of miles from home in a fairgrounds venue. I'm in the field doing the battle reenactment and have no idea this is going on. And a very good friend of mine just happened to see her take off out of the corner of his eye. So anyway, I was on the field, didn't know all this was going on. He took off after her, wound up chasing her halfway through all these fairgrounds, which are several acres. And finally she ran and got underneath the car in a parking lot, and he was able to coax her out and bring her back to camp. So that by the time I returned back to camp after the battle reenactment, it didn't look like anything was wrong, and nobody wanted to tell me right away to upset me. So they sat down later, and the story came out, and it was wonderful because I couldn't be there, but somebody else who knew my River, another member of my extended family, saw what was happening and acted immediately and saved the dog, or I might have never got her back.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful story. I'm not going to say the guy's name, though.
Sure. What is the piece of weaponry you use in your primary impressions?
Oh, there's two of them. I carry a Walther P-38, a 9mm semi-automatic pistol. And that's as an NCO, I carry that. And then my main weapon is a 9mm MP40 machine pistol, as it's called. It's commonly referred to as a Schmeisser, but that's a misnomer. He had nothing to do with the design of the gun. So if somebody ever, if you ever got to describe it, you call it a 9mm MP40. It was a fully automatic machine pistol with a 32-round magazine and an extending steel stock that would extend so you could get better accuracy.
What was the firing rate on that?
I couldn't tell you.
Shit ton?
Yeah, yeah. Although I have heard that, that they were, I've never actually fired a real MP40, but I've been told if you fired off more than a 6 or 7 round burst, they had a tendency to jam sometimes.
Yeah,
but I don't know. Somebody might tell you different.
Is there anything else you would like to share with our audience before we wrap it up? I want to thank you for your time, and with the exception of the air that you guys didn't hear because I edited out with the my microphone cable. Kev, first and foremost, thank you for stepping up and acting as the second, and not only want to say in charge, but when we all showed up, you know, being here, meeting and greeting us, telling us where to set up, and just being an all-around great guy. I greatly appreciate that. And, you know, for guys like me who are driving 2.5 hours, and it's always great to see, you know, a familiar face when you're in a new location. And there's been times driven to Georgia. You're there. I mean, just about any event I go to,
it's
you're
like a
there.
Family reunion.
It doesn't matter if it's an air show. It doesn't matter if it's in a different state. You know, you always seem to be there, and I'm thankful for that, and I'm proud to call you a friend.
I'm proud to call you a friend, and I really have enjoyed the food that you've shared me with me this weekend, and the coffee especially, because it's sure better than the store-bought stuff they're serving us here.
Well, for those you're not familiar with it, go to my YouTube channel over at d-410.com or digital410. And by the way, this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast is brought to you by our friends at At Computers. At Computers has been providing IT solutions for all of Southwest Florida since 2004. So even if you're not in Southwest Florida, they can help you remotely. Give them a call, 239-283-1120, and they can log in your computer remotely and help you out, as well as offer 2-4-month authentication, online backups, and antivirus. That's 239-283-1120. But as I was getting to, if you go on our YouTube channel, you'll see that I built my stovetop in an ammo crate so that I don't have to hide all my stuff under tarps during events. And I built that because one of the hardest parts about doing a 2-3-4 day event is after a while you get tired eating peanut butter and crackers and cold cuts. And so having the ability to pull out a hot plate and make hamburgers in the day, hot dogs, even steaks or pancakes, and hot coffee.
Or coffee.
It just makes the weekend that much more tolerable and actually enjoyable.
I agree with you there. 100%.
So it's my pleasure to help provide you food, because obviously I'm stopping and buying hamburgers. I can't just buy one patty. I got to buy a whole box, and I'm sure not going to eat it, and I don't want it to go to waste. So it's my pleasure to help provide you with some warm food in your tummy and some nice coffee.
I appreciate it. You've seen what my camp looks like, and yeah. It takes looking after all the time.
Yeah. Kevin has his tent set up, and he's the only one with a fly or a canopy, if you will. And we are out in the hot sun, no shade, no trees. I think I almost got heat exhaustion earlier today. And everybody's basically, it doesn't matter, even the Vietnam guys are all sitting underneath his canopy. And so it's just attending, and I'm seeing our fire's going to go out right now. So we're going to wrap up this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. Thank you guys so much, and head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. As always, you can see all the photos of the reenactors involved in this episode, as well as the Patreon link and all the links to our YouTube channel and all that good stuff. Please, if you haven't done so yet, sign up for Patreon. It's $1 a month. They take $1 of your bank account. It helps you go support this podcast. If you sign up for the $7.50 a month plan, you get a free T-shirt after the second month. Thank you guys so much, and we will talk to you all soon. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Don.
This has been a Digital 410 production.